KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit. We'll be back in just a few minutes. KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Howdy, everybody. It's about 6 minutes after 11 p.m. on the 13th of August, 2007. My name is Mike Hagan. I'll be your host for the next 3 hours or so. And the program is called Radio Orbit. We do it every Monday from 11 until 2 and talk to interesting people from around the world. Going to do the same thing tonight. But before we do that, we say thank you. Normally, we thank Debbie Johnson. But Free Range Radio Theater for the last couple weeks has been handled by others here at the station. I'm not sure exactly why, but I'll try to find out. And Debbie, wherever you are, call me, find me, write me. I miss you. Regardless, great stuff on Free Range Radio Theater. Kyle sitting in tonight playing some old Star Trek from vinyl, by the way. And really cool. So thanks, Kyle. He does a great program on Saturday nights, Sunday mornings, by the way. Kyle and his pal Tony do a program called Mystery Science Radio 3000. If you're ever up at 2 a.m. and later on Saturday night, Sunday morning, tune into KOPN. You'll hear Kyle and Tony do it up there. Incredible. Do a great program in the middle of the night on Saturday, Sunday morning. But regardless of the time, great radio. Anyway, tonight, Free Range Radio Theater. Kyle, thanks. Before that, Kelvin and Jason, Do It Up. Jazz plus blues equals fiat currency. Tech Radio keeps us up on the wild world of technology and gadgetry. Jeff Wheeler starts things off every Monday with Uncommon Light, 3 to 5 p.m. Good music, good talk, good news, righteous radio on KOPN, your imagination station. Glad to be here with y'all and a part of it. Okay, thanks very much to all of you who joined us last week. A heartfelt thank you to Boyd Graves. I mean it, you know. I mean, if you folks knew what this guy had been through. I mean, sheesh. This, you know, the show last week was about as important as anything we've done, in my opinion. The U.S. Special Virus Cancer Program. It operated from 1963 through 1978. It operated officially under the auspices of the NCI, the National Cancer Institute, but with contracts and relationships with thousands of hospitals, universities, private contractors, scientists, doctors, the U.S. Special Virus Cancer Program. There were 15 annual progress reports released for this program, one for each and every year of its operation. I have a number of these progress reports. And I'm going to have them all. They paint a very clear picture as to what was going on. Hell, if you want a clear picture of what was going on, flip on over to page 61 of Progress Report number 8 from 1971. You'll actually get a look at a picture. A flow chart, as a matter of fact. And a damn scary one. That lays this whole ugly business out. So what about it? What about it? The U.S. Special Virus Cancer Program. What about it? I'm interested in finding out, and I am certainly going to be asking these questions of our public servants right here in Missouri. In particular, Governor Matt Blunt, there's a letter in the mail to you, sir. Same goes for Claire McCaskill, Chuck Graham, Ed Robb, Kenny Holshoff, Kit Bond, all of my representatives. Let's see you represent me, okay? And again, there are two specific patent numbers that I want documented here on the air. They are number 4647773 and number 5676977. You can look them up yourselves at USPTO.gov. That's the United States Patent and Trademark Office. Go see what you think of those two patents, all right? And then maybe write a letter or two of your own and demand an investigation into the U.S. Special Virus Cancer Program. All right, if you missed the show last week, or any other for that matter, you can always hear them after the fact. They're all on the web, www.mikehagan.com, in the program archives. Tonight, G. Edward Griffin will be discussing the Federal Reserve banking system, what it is, where it came from, who runs it, and why it's problematic. Ed knows more about the Fed than anyone else I'm aware of. Of course, his book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, is a must-read for anyone interested in understanding how the Federal Reserve actually operates. Ed was on the program back in September 2004, and we were talking primarily about globalism and 9/11. And I'm sure some of the things we talked about back then may come up tonight, as many of them are connected. But the focus tonight, fleshing out the Fed, all right? We'll also feature some assorted music tonight. I got a whole bunch of random... What do I call it? I have a bunch of random songs, I guess, that I'd like to share with you tonight. The only two things that they all have in common are, number one, they were all sent to me by listeners, and number two, none of them are identified. I have no idea who any of these artists are that you're hearing tonight. Anyway, talking about music, last week we heard songs from my old friend Steve Kuhn. Nothing available from Steve out there in the larger world, but if you like it, let me know and I'll figure a way to get you some MP3s or something like that. A couple of you have already asked that and sent me notes about it, and I'll get back to you real soon, I promise, okay? By the way, information about all the musicians that I feature on the program here can be found on the web at my site in the music archives. And you can check it out, listen to the music, listen to the talk, and see what you think of any of it, all right? Or all of it, I guess. Okay, either way, good stuff on the way. So hang there with me, and I'll play another one here from who knows who. And we'll come back, taking it all into orbit, all right? It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 effort. KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. G. Edward Griffin in a bit. And now, a song. Thank you. All right, another great song by I'm not sure who. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. About 17 minutes after the hour of 11 p.m. on the 13th of August, 2007. Good to be with you all tonight. And we'll say hello to everybody listening to us this evening on KOPN, over the traditional airwaves or over the internet, live or otherwise. Every Monday we do the show right here from the wonderful studios, KOPN Columbia, lovely downtown Columbia, Missouri. And we stream the show live as well on the web at kopn.org. Just slip on over there to the website and click on the Listen Live button. You'll get a nice 64K stream. And thanks to everyone who makes it happen, live on the radio and live on the net. Larry, the web wizard, let's thank him too. He's back with us doing great stuff, helping us out on the website. You find information about Wary. You can find information about Wary, Larry, on the web at islandsmultimedia.com. Anyway, thanks to everybody else out there sending art, music, poetry, new stuff in the Poets Corner next week. I just got a poem this evening that I didn't have time to get up on the website, but we'll have that up next week. And thanks to everybody. I send it to send more. We'll find a place for it on the website and share it with other people. All right? If you have a chance, go over there, by the way, MikeHagan.com. Check it out. Let me know what you think. You'll have access to everything we're doing over there. So take a look and see and share your thoughts with us. The forum is active and busy and always interesting topics being discussed over there, sometimes related to the program, sometimes not. Lots of things happening that I don't even keep up with anymore, but certainly many things that I do. And it's a very, very cool way to share information, ideas, and discuss, debate, and talk about this sort of stuff. A live chat room up and active, as always, every Monday night. Go to the website again, just click on the live chat link. You can zip on over there and visit with some other folks that are listening to the program, probably over the internet, maybe not. But regardless, people tuned in and chatting about it at the same time. I've been meaning to thank Chaos, and I'll do it again. Thank you, Chaos, for getting the whole chat thing together. It's awesome, and I appreciate everything you've done for the last few weeks. I'll peek in there over the evening for questions and comments. If you got something that you have on your mind for Ed Griffin with regard to the Federal Reserve or many of the other things that he's capable of talking about, just post it up there on the chat, and I'll try to grab those things as I see them and share them with Ed if I get the opportunity, okay? All right, I always encourage my guests as well as listeners to join us in the chat and the forum. The forum's happening, of course, 7 days a week. The chat can happen anytime you guys decide to use it. Most of the time it happens during the program primarily, but you know, you can use it anytime you like. And anyway, both those vehicles, great ways to find the others, as it were. Okay. All right, my email address, orbitradio, O-R-B-I-T-R-A-D-I-O, orbitradio@AOL.com. Send email to me. Send email to my guests. Send email to the musicians that perform on the program. All these people are really interested in hearing what you think about what they're doing, what they're saying, what they're playing, myself included. And, you know, good, bad, or ugly, let us know what you think. On the web, you can always get a hold of me at MikeHagan, H-A-G-A-N.com. The phone number here in the studio, 874-5676. That's area code 573. You can always call me on a break and let me know what you think. 573-874-5676. And if we take any calls on the air with Mr. G. Edward Griffin, that number will be 573-443-8255. That'll be coming up in about 40 minutes. We'll have Ed Griffin on the air with us at the top of the hour. In the meantime, we'll take care of some regular old stuff, if you know what I mean. Upcoming guests. Next week, the birthday show. 3 years, Radio Orbit, on the air. Can you believe it? I can't, actually. Well, I can and I can't. But anyway, we're going to have a party next week down here at the station. Come on down if you're listening to this broadcast and you like what you hear and you're interested in hanging out for a little while with other people like you that are listening to the program and just me and my family and friends. Next week, the 20th of August, the birthday show. 3-year anniversary for Radio Orbit. Come on down, party it up with us, okay? The week after that, 27th of August, John Major Jenkins. John will be returning to the program. He's been here on the air with me a number of times over the last few years. Good friend and a guy who I think is doing great work and someone who I just can't say enough good things about. So listen to some of the previous programs that John has done with me and maybe you'll think the same. He's wonderful. And he'll be on the air with me on the 27th of August, a couple of weeks from tonight. Okay? On the 3rd of September, Susan Renison. She's written a book called Tuning the Diamonds that has to do with planetary evolution, and it's an interesting book, and she has some interesting ideas that are articulated really well. She's going to be on the program on the 3rd of September, Susan Renison. Okay? After that, we'll do a 9/11 special, Kent Daniel Benkowski. Kent's a great researcher and political commentarian, if that's a word. And we'll have Kent on the air with us on the 10th of September. The 17th, Bruce Raphael and Rush Allen. We'll talk a little bit more about the Lionsgate cosmology and some of the things that they're uncovering there in China. Brian Trent, the author of Remembering Hypatia. The 24th of September, one of my favorite books that I've read over the last few years, Brian Trent, back with us in a few weeks. Dennis McKenna, my brother, October 1st. Can't wait to have Dennis back on the program. Something to look forward to. And Bruce Lipton on the 15th of October. So, good stuff for the next few months for sure. Hope you all appreciate and enjoy it. And we'll continue on as long as we're capable. All right? Okay. It's time to play another song. Why not? Come back. I'll talk a little bit about space weather, a few things in the news we can talk about, a little bit about Ed Griffin maybe before he gets on the air, talk about the party coming up next week. Got a lot of things going on, but we'll come back in a few minutes and talk about that stuff. In the meantime, let's play a little bit more music here. This one is from, again, I have no idea. Back in a minute. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia.
From here to Salvador, the lady star, to fill us restless sons with the passions of the heart. Going round Gemma's to life and
sorry, I'm working here.
And you're ruining it.
Yeah, but like, do you want to have an argument over records? Do you know what I mean?
KLPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit. And it's about 11:30. A little bit before that, but about 11:30 or so. And let's talk about space weather, okay? The Perseid meteor shower continues tonight. Great stuff. The show is not over, all right? If you haven't been paying attention, well, do so tonight. You'll see some great stuff up there in the sky tomorrow as well. The Perseids peaked last night, I guess I would say, but you can still see quite a bit of action up there in the skies. And bright enough even to pierce the twilight last night. So if you're interested in this sort of thing, go on outside around dusk tomorrow and stay up as long as you like, but look towards the west, southwest, I believe, is the right... I mean, look anywhere, but that's probably a more concentrated area of meteors if you're looking to see that type of phenomenon, and you might see some great light show tomorrow up in the sky. There was another meteor shower that I actually wasn't aware of until a day or two ago this weekend. It was called the Arachnid meteor shower, and anyway, a true spider's web being thrown out of that constellation. And this is the way they name all these meteor showers. They basically name them according to the constellation from which they appear to come from the direction of. Doesn't mean they come from, you know, Perseus. It means that when you look at it from the perspective of, you know, North America, that it appears to come from that direction. So, anyway, always interesting things up there in the sky above our heads. What else do we have happening up there? We've got the Comet 125 Space Watch, which is going on right now. Started just a day or so ago. We've got the Workshop on Ices, Oceans, and Fire, Satellites of the Outer Solar System. We have the 70th Annual Meeting of the Meteorological Society in Tucson, Arizona. The Conference on Star Formation Through Cosmic Time in Santa Barbara, California. One of the many workshops on dark matter and dark energy in Beijing, China. Of course, no one knows what they're working on. what else? Oh, the regular comets and asteroids that are always zipping by us. Here's one, asteroid 2404 Antarctica, zipping by here pretty quickly on the 17th. There is a lecture on Saturn's moon, Enceladus, coming up on the 17th. The 130th anniversary of the discovery of Phobos, which is an interesting satellite of the planet Mars. A gentleman named Asaph Hall discovered that in 1877, and Phobos is one that we've been watching for a long time. Guys like Kent and I, Kent Stedman from over there at cyberspaceorbit.com, probably, you know, wind us up and just set us off talking about things like Phobos. But at any rate, it was discovered about 130 years ago. What else? Space Shuttle Endeavour is supposed to return to Earth on the 19th. The European Planetary Science Congress assembles the 19th through the 24th in Potsdam, Germany. All right. Let's see. What else we have in the news here with regard to space? NASA. Astronomers are scheduled to announce new findings from NASA's Galaxy Evolution Explorer about a star unlike any seen before. And then it gives a list of the briefing participants. They're making a big deal out of this on Wednesday, August 15th. My birthday, by the way. Going to be a big deal about some new star that a fancy NASA satellite has supposedly discovered and is now observing. I think this is all phooey. Okay. A star unlike any seen before. There's only one star that has been seen before. And that's the one that's 93 million miles or so away from us. And we don't know much about that one. Even though we like to talk about, you know, all of our wonderful, you know, discoveries and knowledge about our own star. We don't know diddly about old Sol up there. And, you know, you don't have to take my word for it. Just go, you know, look in the archives of Space Weather and some of these other websites that that report on solar phenomenon. You don't even have to look back that far. You just look back 10 years, and you'll find out that over the last 10 years, there have been all kinds of astonishing events on the sun that nobody had any idea, you know, were going to occur, and that nobody had any explanation for, and to this day has no explanation for. You know, they're just fishing. The ideas of what the sun is, what it actually is, change all the time. I mean, it was an iron-burning furnace not that long ago. Then we moved into the age of nuclear science and this sort of thing, so of course now it becomes a nuclear furnace, right? I mean, the sun becomes whatever the scientific paradigm on the Earth seems to think that it is. It doesn't mean that that's what it is. But now they're going to tell you about a star, you know, that's a billion light years away or whatever. It's just silliness, you know? It's a bunch of monkeys pulling their puds and trying to actually convince themselves that they know what they're talking about. And it's really what it is. I mean, why don't they concentrate on the one star that we actually have some data on and give us some relevant, pertinent, and accurate data about that star? Nobody knows what's happening on our star. You know? And they're going to tell us about all these other ones? It's, you know, I mean, come on, you guys. Make your own mind up about it. But, you know, isn't there something a little fishy about that? There's a lot of fishy things about science. Just like there's a lot of fishy things about religion. And a lot of fishy things about all the institutions that we bow down to. Bunch of silly people. Acting like they know stuff. And so then a bunch of then everybody else, you know, assumes that they actually do. That's the real con, you know? And it's your own damn fault, you know? And mine too. All right, what else? Sky Notes, August 14th, tomorrow. The moon's only about 2 days old. You had new moon yesterday. Tomorrow you'll see a little bit of a crescent waxing just low in the evening twilight. You'll find it about 30 minutes after sunset. Just look to the west, okay? On the 15th of August, on Wednesday, Mercury is at what they call superior conjunction. This is the place in a planet's orbit when it's on the other side of the solar system from us. So on the 15th, Mercury will be behind the sun, and it's an orbit that's actually tilted from the Earth's orbit by 6 or 7 degrees or so. So it's not exactly in line with the sun. If you could actually see Mercury, it'd be like maybe 2 degrees above the sun in the sky. Venus and Saturn will also be up in the daytime sky. We'll be able to see them. Venus about 8 degrees from the sun. Saturn maybe a few less than that. What you can see on the 15th is the moon. Look after sunset and you'll see the 3-day-old moon low in the western sky. A little beautiful crescent that'll be getting bigger over the next couple weeks. All right? Okay. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. We got G. Edward Griffin, the author of The Creature from Jekyll Island, among other things, coming up with us in about 22 minutes or so. On the web, if you want to get a leg up, you can go over to Ed's website. He has a couple of them. The first one, and I think the most relevant one tonight, is called Freedom Force International. freedomforceinternational.org. You can link there directly from my site at mikehagan.com, or you can just go there yourself, Freedom Force International. And there's another website called Reality Zone, realityzone.com, and lots of Ed's books and materials are available there at Reality Zone, plus some commentary about them. Okay? So freedomforceinternational.org, realityzone.com, G. Edward Griffin. He's my guest in about 20 minutes. It'll be a interesting show for people who are interested in the way money is created, essentially, and the way the banking system works, the way the federal government manages money, all that stuff. We'll be talking about it tonight with G. Edward Griffin, and he is a man who knows a whole lot about it. Check out The Creature from Jekyll Island, an amazing book written many years ago, but one that's still talked about a lot today, okay? All right, it's Mike, and this is Radio Orbit, KOPN, Columbia. Check this out, another wonderful song that I don't know anything about. KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM.
Son como el viento, ¿verdad?
ESPN Columbia. You're listening to Radio Orbit. My name is Mike Hagan. It's just a few minutes, well, 12 or 13 minutes before the midnight hour. Coming up on the 14th of August, 2007. And it's glad to be with you. I'm glad to be with you all tonight. A couple things in the news here before we get to our guest at the top of the hour, G. Edward Griffin. On the web, if you want to catch up with the people who've been looking already, zip on over to my website at MikeHagan.com. That's MikeHagan.com. Or you can go over to Ed Griffin's site. He has a couple of them, freedomforceinternational.org and realityzone.com. Okay? And those sites are both linked from my site on the front page there. So if you're interested in going over there before we get Ed on the line here, you can get a leg up on the people who haven't done so. Okay? All right. In the meantime, in the news, what's happening here? Well, there's a hurricane in Hawaii, or that's on the way toward Hawaii. And I just thought I'd mention it because we have a lot of people that listen to the program on the islands. And the reason we have lots of people that listen to the program on the islands is because we have a lot of guests from the islands. Marco Roden, Michael and Star, Nassim, a number of other people that live there in Hawaii. Of course, Larry lives over there now, you know, the web wizard. And so we have lots of friends and acquaintances and guests over there in the Hawaiian island chain. And, well, we're just sort of watching as this Hurricane Flossie sort of bears down now on the island chain. And for the last few days, it has been thought that there wasn't going to be really, you know, a problem. They thought that it would that it was going to miss the islands. But now it seems to be sort of bearing right in there. I'll read a little bit from the most recent weather release here. But, well, the gist of the matter is that you know, they're battening down the hatches. So anyway, good luck to everybody out there in Hawaii. Hope everything goes okay, and maybe that thing will change course before it nails you. All right, what else? The shuttle. The space shuttle has another problem with its shielding and its re-entry tiles and all this stuff. There is a gash that went all the way through one of the tiles, and NASA put out a story today about it, and they're trying to decide whether they need to repair it or not. But it's like, I mean, how many times does this stuff have to happen before you fix it? I mean, what the... I mean, the whole space shuttle program is like, you know, it's like out of The Simpsons or something. I mean, 40 years ago, we were basically doing the same thing, you know, blasting off rockets. And the space shuttle is really nothing more than that. It's just a, you know, they just put a little orbiter on top of three big giant rockets. And... you know, it just seems to be silly to me. I just don't get it. I mean, look at what's happened to computer technology in the last 40 years. You know, it just doesn't jive, the fact that they're still doing this. It's like a Simpsons episode where Homer gets that, you know, he's looking for a camper or a motorhome, and he can only afford that old cheapo one. That seems like that's what's going on. NASA should have been able to afford much better. And I know there are better ideas out there. I just think there's maybe another agenda at work, perhaps. At any rate, the space shuttle astronauts, the most recent guinea pigs, they got this to deal with now again. You know? It's Groundhog Day. Deja vu. More damage to the tiles of the space shuttle. Fix the damn thing, for God's sake. How about, here's another idea. How about you start using flying saucers or whatever to do all this business? And share them with us while you're at it. All right. What else? Marijuana dealers offer Schwarzenegger $1 billion. This is great. Listen to this. August 6th, a coalition of California marijuana growers and dealers has offered Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger $1 billion to solve the current state budget crisis. The group, calling itself Let Us Pay Taxes, makes the offer through its website, letuspaytaxes.com. The offer comes at a time when the California legislature is deadlocked on a new budget and California has stopped issuing checks for vitally needed social services. Legislators are currently arguing over which programs will be cut in order to balance the budget. This is the greatest. This stuff is just the greatest. Listen to this. There's more. It's ridiculous that California can't pay its bills, said spokesman Clifford Schaefer. It's a tragedy that they will cut badly needed services and programs such as medical care for the elderly and prison drug treatment when the money to fund all these programs and more is there and available. Everyone who is currently waiting for a check from the state should be enraged at this foolishness. Of course, spokesman Clifford Schaefer is probably not enraged by the foolishness because he's probably still getting his check. Maybe he'll get more upset if they don't pay him. Anyway, regulation and taxation of cannabis could produce $6 billion, which I disagree with, by the way. Regulation and taxation, I agree with regulation and taxation of everything. But anyway, regulation and taxation of marijuana, except propaganda. Regulation and taxation of marijuana could produce $6 billion in additional tax revenue that they could blow, according to an economic study linked from their website, la la la. Anyway, this is great stuff because, I mean, you know, how much more in your face does the whole silliness have to get? We got dealers and growers offering the governments of states money, you know, outright, to help them with their financial woes, just to get them off their back, because everybody knows it's a joke anyway. Here's another one that's a follow-up on the forum thread that the original story was posted on. Now this is a more ugly side of it, actually, when you start to think about it. But this story here says, hybrid marijuana plant found in Mexico. Soldiers trying to seize control of one of Mexico's top drug-producing regions found the countryside teeming with a new hybrid marijuana plant that can be cultivated year-round and cannot be killed with herbicides. These plants have been genetically improved, he told a handful of journalists allowed to accompany soldiers, before we could cut the plant and destroy it. But this plant will come back to life unless it's taken out by the roots. Well, you know, pot smokers might think that's a great thing, but now, you know, it's sort of like Roundup Ready corn. The plant can survive being sprayed with all this poison and stuff, and it doesn't mean that it's not going to transfer that stuff to you. It just means that it can survive it. And so who knows what they're doing now, you know, producing all these genetically engineered hybrids and stuff just to avoid the attacks of the so-called drug warriors, and they're the guys that are basically selling it and distributing most of it anyway. You know, the global drug trade is primarily run by state-sponsored distributors, including this state sponsor, the United States of America. So the whole thing's just a complete ruse, and there's been nothing good come from it. People are going to do their drugs whether they got to buy them from the CIA or not. And in the meanwhile, you got all kinds of people going to jail, all kinds of people being killed, all kinds of people been, you know, their lives have been ruined for a bunch of bullshit, a bunch of just a ruse, a complete and utter pottage. Anyway, hopefully that's all going to end very soon. All right, it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. We'll be back in just a few minutes with G. Edward Griffin. In the meantime, here is a song. It's KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM.
To Radio Orbit with Mike Hagan on KOPN 89.5 FM.
Hi, everybody. It is Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia. My guest tonight is G. Edward Griffin. He's a writer, an historian, a documentary film producer. His research has dealt with such diverse subjects as archaeology, ancient Earth history, the Federal Reserve System, about which we'll be talking about tonight, international banking, terrorism, taxation, U.S. foreign policy, cancer therapy, the Supreme Court, and the United Nations. One of his best-known works is entitled The Creature from Jekyll Island, A Second Look at the Federal Reserve. And tonight, for those uninitiated, we'll take a first look as well. He was on the program nearly 3 years ago, and it's a pleasure to welcome him back to Radio Orbit. Ed, hello. Thanks so much for being back here.
Well, hello, Mike. Thanks for inviting me back.
It's a pleasure to have you back on the program, Ed. Well, it's been a while. It's actually interesting because I was listening to the show that we did 3 years ago, and I thought, the next time I talk to Ed, hopefully I won't have to ask any of the same questions. But turns out things haven't changed all that much, frankly. But we're going to talk about some different things, actually, tonight than we did the first time we talked to Ed. And I think I'd like to start with, well, money. The world apparently runs around money. And in a situation like that, I guess the first thing you need to do is understand it. So maybe we could talk a little bit about money and then how the Federal Reserve is a part of that whole puzzle.
Well, I think that's a good connection, Mike, because when you mention the Federal Reserve to people, they get kind of a glazed look in their eye, and then they, who cares about that? But as you just pointed out, if you care about money, and I think everybody cares about money, regardless of whether they like it or hate it, they all want more of it, and you realize that money is created by the Federal Reserve System in this country, and knowing about how money comes into creation and how it's extinguished and all of that is a very important thing if you want to acquire some of it, because there are certain rules to the game, and if you know the rules, you have a chance of winning the game. You may not win the game because you may not be proficient at following the rules, but if you don't even know the rules or that there's even a game being played, you can be sure you're out.
Right.
So, yeah, money is a very important topic, and it's not one of those dirty topics that sometimes you think about. People say, oh, money is dirty. I don't want anything to do with money, that sort of thing. No, money is a very honorable topic. Money serves a good purpose. It always has throughout history. Economies and nations and societies, civilizations could not exist at a very high level without money. So what is money? Okay, that's a good question. Money is very simple. It's merely it's a medium of exchange. It can take many forms, but it's whatever people want to use to exchange value between themselves.
So anytime a group makes a consensus agreement that something is worth something, it becomes money, essentially.
Yeah, anytime you exchange something for value of some other form, then that, whatever you're using to exchange is money.
Hmm.
It doesn't have to be printed by the government. In fact, historically, money seldom was. It started off always as some private commodity that people created themselves.
Hmm.
It could, in the very beginning, it was usually something very useful, like food. In a primitive society, you don't have much use for anything except food and shelter and then weapons
and tools.
So
and so
in the beginning, food was quite often the medium of exchange. And in ancient societies, you can tell by the records in the clay tablets from Nineveh and from Babylon and ancient Persia, these clay tablets were a lot of them just keeping record of how many bowls of wheat were exchanged between parties. And that was the money of that period, wheat. It could be used. It had value to everybody. It could be measured. They had certain jars of certain sizes, and so everything was measured in terms of jars of wheat. Then later on, cattle became useful as a means of money. In fact, the word pecunia, which survives into our language when we talk about a pecuniary advantage, meaning a monetary advantage.
Right.
Pecunia is a Latin word, and it comes from the word cow. So that's a little historic remnant of one of the earlier forms of money. Well, as society advanced and the economies became more sophisticated, so did the money. Civilizations learned that food was very valuable as a medium of exchange, but food could rot. Wheat could rot. Cattle could die. They could get sick. And so there was always a risk with that kind of money.
Hmm.
And then how old was the cow? Another issue.
Right. When will it die? Yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of issues made it difficult to establish a real hard value of that exchange unit. And so they gradually discovered other things that could be more reliable, such as metals. They found when they could begin to refine metals, first for jewelry, and then for tools and weapons, and they found ways to refine the metals and make real copper, and then iron, and brass, and so forth, that these became the medium of exchange in early societies. But inevitably, everywhere in the world, it settled down to two metals that were considered, we still consider them today, to be precious metals, and that's gold and silver.
Right.
And there was a good reason for that. It was nobody dictating it. Nobody passed a decree in the government and said, we're going to use gold and silver as money.
Yeah, that's a good question. Why were those two chosen above any other metals?
Well, first of all, they were rare. So you could have great value in small quantity.
Hmm.
I mean, you could make trees money, but it's pretty hard to carry trees around and, you know, negotiate a cup of coffee with a tree trunk.
Right. Okay, so small and rare.
So the great value in small quantity was one highly desirable feature of gold and silver. Another thing is that the purity could be determined with great accuracy. By a certain point in history, they knew how to assay metals. Archimedes pretty well worked that out in ancient Greece, and you could measure the purity of a metal even in primitive times. So that was valuable. Another feature is that it didn't deteriorate; it didn't rot. Silver will tarnish a little bit, but gold doesn't. It doesn't do anything. It doesn't tarnish. It doesn't it doesn't rust or anything.
Right.
So. And another thing is it could be divided. It could be melted into small units or put all together in big units. So all of these features of precious metals made them ideally suited for being chosen as a convenient monetary system. So that's why in all of the advanced societies of the world, over time, they all adopted gold and silver as the basis for their monetary unit. Well, it had great common sense to do that because the item you were exchanging itself had intrinsic value. It was wanted. It was useful. It could be used for tools. It could be used for jewelry.
Right, right. You could reform it into whatever you like.
Whatever you like, yes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So all of these features were available for gold and silver,
right.
And it became an ideal monetary unit. And so, as I think most people know this, but it's interesting to recover or to cover some of that history again. Gradually, the ingots of these metals were traded over large distances, and finally, the ingots were put into round forms, and they were called coins.
Mm.
And by this time, the emperors and kings of the regions began to stamp their faces on the coins, which was fine because in a way that signified that this coin came from the realm of a certain emperor, and there was a reputation that that coin was could be depended on to be of intrinsic value, that they weren't cheating. You know, it was a valuable coin.
The content of the coin.
The content of the coin and the size of it,
mm-hmm.
and the weight of it.
Mm-hmm.
They developed reputations over a period of time.
So
right away.
So originally, it was really just about the coin itself, not the coin as a symbol for value, but the value of the coin itself and what.
Exactly.
It,
yes.
Mm-hmm.
True money in that fashion, how it originated. True money has intrinsic value, and that's why it became accepted as money. But then now.
Wow! What a nice idea.
Yeah, what a novel idea. Now history progresses, and the kings decide they want more of these gold coins than they're able to collect in taxes. And so they begin to shave the edges of these coins and trim off just a little bit of gold filing from each coin, melt that down into a new coin. Now the same amount of gold produces more coins. And And this is the beginning of all the problems of the modern monetary systems, is when they began to shave the coins and cheapen the value of the coins. The coin still said, 1 ounce or whatever they said to indicate the quantity of the gold, but they lied. So it didn't have the full value in it. Well, sooner or later, the population caught on to that, and they could look at a coin and say, hey, this coin has been shaved. So even though it says it's 1 ounce, we know it's not. Now, if it were a real 1 ounce coin, we'd accept it for, let's say 20 bushels of corn. But we know it's not a full ounce. So we're going to demand, we're only going to give 18 bushels of corn for this coin. And that was the first instance of inflation. In other words, the price went up.
Right, because the value of the currency went down.
Because the value of the currency went down, exactly.
Hmm.
So it's a really interesting history. And then, of course, after that experience, then the banks began to materialize. The banks really took that clipping of the coin concept to a far greater level. In the beginning, of course, there were no banks. There were goldsmiths. And, craftsmen who would take the gold and form it into bracelets or necklaces or plates or cups and bowls and things. And they were the guardians of large amounts of these precious metals, and they had to have safe places for them. They had to have guards. They had to have structures which were secure.
Right.
And so people began to come to them and said, look, you've got the vault, you've got the warehouse, you've got the guard. We'd like to pay you to hold on to our little supply of gold coins. Would you do that?
Mm.
And of course, it's sure, for a fee. And that was the beginning of banking, is when people would take their gold coins or the silver coins to the goldsmiths and put them in their vaults for safekeeping in return for a fee. Now, what happened is that the goldsmiths, this didn't happen all at once, but over a period of hundreds of years of trial and error, they discovered that the population had a great deal of confidence that the goldsmiths would properly guard their coins, and they very seldom came and asked for them back. All they just wanted to do is know that the gold was there, and in return they had a receipt. They had a paper receipt for that gold. So what that really meant is that, let's say I put an ounce of gold into your vault and you gave me a paper receipt. It says the bearer of this receipt is entitled to 1 ounce of gold in my vault.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm walking around with this paper in my pocket and I see something I want to buy that's worth 1 ounce of gold.
Mm-hmm.
Now I can run back to the goldsmith, turn in my paper receipt, get my 1 ounce of gold and go down and buy it, or I can go to the storekeeper and say, look, let me give you my receipt.
Right.
You know this is a good receipt,
right,
because
right.
We know this guy's been honorable for years, and so you have the gold without having to go pick it up. You just hold on to the receipt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the storekeeper says, yeah, that's a good idea. And when that transaction first happened, we had the beginning of paper money.
Right. Right.
Yeah, that's when paper money became into vogue, because it represented gold. It wasn't that the paper was worth anything. It's just that the people who held the paper were guaranteed that if they went to the goldsmith and they presented that receipt, is what it was, that they could get the gold. And so the paper money functioned very well indeed in the beginning.
You know, Ed, it also served to a greater extent the earlier purpose that you mentioned, i.e., it was easier to move around.
Oh, yeah, much easier to carry
gold and silver,
of paper.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, yeah, much lighter and easier to conceal and so forth.
And again, now my mind moves forward, and I think, well, now they don't even use paper.
It's plastic.
Right, it's plastic, and it's ethereal. It's just a keystroke or whatever, you know?
Well, that didn't happen all at once, of course, but then the next step in this evolution, Mike, is that that the goldsmiths, the craftsmen, discovered that very few people came to get their gold at one time. You know, like 90% of the gold just sat there, and the paper receipts circulated throughout society.
Right.
So what they decided to do is that they would loan gold out at interest. Now, they didn't loan their own gold only. They would loan some of their own gold, but they wouldn't have to actually loan the gold. They could just loan the paper receipts, you understand. So, but they discovered that since not more than 10 or 15% of the people could be expected to come in for their paper receipts at any one time, they started to loan out the other people's gold. They started giving paper receipts not only for the gold they owned, but the paper receipts for the gold that other people had deposited into their vaults.
But still, it was just a one-to-one thing. In other words, they weren't loaning out more money than they actually had in the vault.
No, just the opposite. When they took this step, Mike, now you understand the original depositor had a paper receipt for that ounce of gold. And now the goldsmith just loaned out another paper receipt against that same ounce of gold. So now there are two paper receipts for that same. And then eventually three, and then four, and five, and up to nine, so forth. And this was a marvelous game because the goldsmiths could collect interest on money that they really didn't even have. Just on paper receipts that really looked like they were worth something because it said you could collect your gold, but it really was a worthless piece of paper because if everybody did try to collect their gold, there wasn't enough there to do it.
So it was a scam,
and it worked, and that is the birth of modern banking, believe it or not.
You know, time frame wise, how long ago was it when this sort of stuff was going on?
Oh, this was going on 400, 500, 600 years ago. You know, it took a long time to develop. It became more sophisticated in small increments as it went. There were periods, short periods of time in history when there was honest banking. There were some small examples in Italy where there were a couple of banks.
That's ironic.
And they actually did keep all the gold in their vaults and so forth, but the temptation was always too great. You could make a lot more money by loaning out paper receipts that didn't really have gold behind them.
Right.
So all of the banks in time were, you know, they were tempted by that, and they all gradually accepted that model. That's the model we have today. Banking is, you know, you go, you put your money in a bank, and you're given a checkbook, and you're told that that is a demand deposit, which means that you can get your money back anytime you want, right? Yet they give you checks.
Right.
So now you think, that's great. So they're holding my money for me, but at the same time, the bank takes your deposit and uses that as a basis for leveraging loans to other people. So they got a lot of loans out based on your deposit. So if everybody or even a small percentage those people all wanted their money at the same time, the bank physically cannot do it. And that's why back in the 20s and 30s we had those examples of runs on the bank when people would line up outside the bank, you know, and they said, we want our money, and the banks would slow down the tellers and say, give them their money, but take a long time, count it and recount it. They'll get tired and go home. And that usually worked, but every once in a while, they didn't get tired and go home. They just stood in line, and so finally the banks had to close their windows, and they would declare bank holidays, and the game was up.
Well, we'll talk more about that particular idea a little bit later, I think, because there are at least a reasonable number of people that are talking about these types of situations occurring in the not-so-distant future, perhaps, because we're in the middle of a very interesting economic situation right now, it seems. But anyway, let's talk a little bit more about the past before we talk about the present, okay?
Yes. Well, anyway, that's how money began. It started out as an honorable mechanism for people to participate in barter.
And a reasonable one.
And a very reasonable one, and a necessary one. But then those with clever minds and sophisticated abilities to deceive the public.
Right, and ill-intentioned. My God.
Absolutely ill-intentioned. It was a very clever thing, and the average person couldn't figure it out, you see. And, of course, today it's much more sophisticated than just clipping coins or loaning out more than you've got in the vault. It's much more sophisticated than that. And the average person really has trouble trying to figure it out. So they just say, well, I guess this is too complicated for a dumb guy like me, you know. I'm sure that the government's looking after it, and they'll protect me, you know. And that's the mentality that we have. So, as I said earlier, if you know the game and you know the rules of the game, you at least can protect yourself. But if you don't understand what's going on, there's no chance in the world that you're going to win this money game. So, anyway, I don't know how much we want to dwell in history. It has evolved to a much more sophisticated mechanism than that. But underneath it all, that is still what's happening in modern banking today. The one major difference is that at the turn of the last century, or before that, I should say, at the beginning of the 1900s, you see, money was still backed by precious metals. If you go to a coin shop and you look at some of those old historic bills that they might have on display or sell to you, they'll say gold certificate or silver certificate. I remember, as a boy, we used to have... They were still silver certificates in circulation. I still have a little collection of them, interesting collection of $2 silver certificates. And you could have, in those days, you could take those to the Federal Reserve or to the government, or take them to a bank and demand your silver. Well, that was then. This is now.
And many of those, or the great majority of those, bills have been removed from circulation.
Oh, yes.
Right? Long ago.
Oh, yeah. They no longer would be honored.
Really? They wouldn't even honor it anymore?
Oh, no.
I mean, if you had a silver shirt, they wouldn't honor it.
Oh, no. Oh, no, no.
That's remarkable.
Oh, no, yeah. The laws have been passed so that banks are not required to honor those anymore. They're just historic collector's pieces now. So the point I was going to make with that is that at the turn of the century, if people went to the bank and demanded their deposits in gold or silver, there was a physical limitation to what the banks could do. They could only hold so much gold or silver.
So
there was a point that came very quickly when their shenanigans were exposed. They just ran out of gold and silver. That was it. End of game. But now... there's no gold or silver at all behind these bills. And so if you go into the bank and you say you want your money, you want to convert your checkbook money into currency, all they got to do is just turn on the printing press.
Right.
So you may have a little delay in getting your money, but you'll get it. The trouble is you won't get it in gold or silver or anything of lasting value. You'll just get it in paper, just paper. And it'll work for a while. The problem is that this process has a price tag to it. And the price tag is the devaluation of the currency. The money keeps getting less and less valuable as they print more and more of it, as they create more and more of it in checkbook money, and as the quantity of money constantly expands at a rate much faster than the expansion of goods and services. That means that the value of the money keeps going down, down, and down. And so today you're paying $20,000 for an automobile that back when I was a boy you could buy for $500.
And this is the nature or the definition of what they call fiat currency, right?
Exactly.
Would you talk about that just for a minute before we take a break here?
Yes. Well, fiat currency, the word fiat comes from the French word meaning edict or law. It means that the value of the currency of the money is just... declared to have value by the government, and you have to accept it by law. It's not something that you do voluntarily because you believe it has intrinsic value, and because you want it. You have no choice. It's just declared as legal tender, and for all debts, private and public, and if you don't accept it, you go to jail. So that's fiat money, and that's the curse of all of the nations of history. That's destroyed them all economically, And that's the system we have today.
Yeah, just to be clear. So we are under a system that operates via fiat currency.
Absolutely. We're on a very steep downhill slope.
And that changed early in the 20th century?
Well, it changed. It took a little while to change. It didn't happen all at once. But it changed by 1913, mm-hmm. when the Federal Reserve Act was passed into law. That was the beginning of the complete changeover. Prior to that, the money was said to be backed by precious metals, and it was, as a matter of fact, but already the federal government did not have enough gold or silver to back all of the currency that was out there.
Okay.
They didn't have it, and nor did the banks. So they had a lot, and there was never a point at that point in history where people weren't able to get it if they were willing to wait a little while. So it was a mixed bag. It was not a completely 100% gold-backed currency. It was a partially backed gold currency. But as the years went by, the percentages kept dropping. First it was 80%, then 70%, 60%, 50%, 40%, 20%, 10%, and now it's zero.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
All right. Look, and let's take a little break here. We'll come back in a few minutes, okay?
You bet.
All right, everybody. My guest is G. Edward Griffin. You can find information about Ed and his work on the web at freedomforceinternational.org. You can also link directly there from my site at mikehagan.com. You can also find lots of Ed's publications, his books, his some videos that he's been a part of, and lots of other interesting stuff at realityzone.com. And I encourage all of you to go over there either now or sometime after the program and check out what they're doing at both of those sites, okay? All right, it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. It's about 30 minutes after the midnight hour, now on the 14th of August, 2007. It's a pleasure to have Ed Griffin with us on the air. We'll come back with him in just a few. In the meanwhile, we'll hear another piece of music here. And as I've been mentioning all night, I have no idea what I'm playing tonight. So here's another one that I don't know anything about. KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit. We'll be back with G. Edward Griffin in just a few minutes.
As I sit in my B-boy stand with flip-flops and socks and sweatpants, hoping to enhance your brain. Check it out. Once upon a time, not long ago, when the player from the point didn't have no flow, a nigga hit me from a tennis shoe, walking to the floor, caught up nigga slipping, but now I link it to the flow just like Harvin, cause I got the heat in my baby mama name, I never bragging just to say not, even when I was a younger lad, I learned my lesson, never talk to strangers in the trap and ask them questions,
the Pope and the Coast got us under the scope, but for unknown reasons, cause we don't sell dope that you distribute, we don't contribute to your clandestine activity, my soliloquy may be hard for some to swallow, but so is Carl Everore, you went behind my back like Pluto when he cut up all the poor. Two things I hate, lies and things they make my blood boil. But we're constricted on my soul that they call. We won't be able to ride out to 2004.
But not for long, cause we got a better stack to serve. Trying to take your other people for your rims, hit your curve, for your swerve and bust your overhead. Go ahead. More head for me while you ride to the meat.
Draw like tears, like for fears. You know, shout, let it all out just for my peers. And pupils who feel like it's time to unwind, like December 31st, 1999.
All right, everybody. Hi, it's Mike. Back at you here, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. You're listening to Radio Orbit. It's about 12:30, just a little bit after that. Going on 1 o'clock here in about 25 minutes or so. We've got G. Edward Griffin with us on the line from his home in California, I guess, right, Ed? You're in California?
That's right.
Northern California?
Southern.
Southern California, okay. Anyway, well, let's get back to it here. We're about to the point, I think, where we need to talk about the reserve itself and when, how, where, why, and who.
That's a lot of questioning here. Let's see, how will we start on that? I think we have to understand what the Federal Reserve System is.
Yeah,
probably is a good way to begin. That's not the way I usually approach the topic, but maybe that's the way we want to do it tonight. A lot of people think that the Federal Reserve is an agency of the federal government.
Right, part of the U.S. government, certainly,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's what I thought.
That's what I thought, for sure,
yeah.
Until I read your book.
Yeah, well, it's not. It's authorized by the government, of course. It's a corporation, a special corporation that was created by an act of Congress, but it's not a part of the government. It's a corporation, and what it really is a structure that holds a cartel. It is, in essence, Mike, a cartel. Federal Reserve, let me state it in very plain English, is nothing more or less than a cartel. It's no different than the oil cartel or the banana cartel or any kind of a cartel. It just happens to be a banking cartel, which means that it's a grouping of independent companies, in this case banks,
mm-hmm.
who on the surface appear to be competitors with each other. They are privately owned, separately owned, but they have entered into a series of agreements with each other to reduce or to eliminate competition between themselves in order to enhance their profits. The idea is to share patents and processes. They agree with each other not to compete on price, for example. They'll agree to compete, not to compete on product. A typical cartel would be, let's say, well, you produce the widget and I'll produce the gizmo. Another cartel would say, well, you can have North America, I get South America, and we
mm-hmm.
won't compete,
mm-hmm.
and so forth.
Yeah, no
it's,
different than a drug gang or anything else.
That's right. It's an agreement to work together and not to compete with each other so that they don't have to sacrifice profits. They can treat the market as one monopoly, in other words. And that's what a cartel is, and that is what the Federal Reserve System is. You see, what happened is that at the turn of the century, when the Federal Reserve came into being, there was a lot of concern among the American people over the banking system. They were very unhappy with it. They knew that there was a lot of control in the hands of a few very powerful banking institutions on Wall Street in New York, and they wanted to break the grip of that control. There had been a lot of bank runs. Some banks had folded, and people lost their money in the banks. And the American people and Congress was pretty determined to do something about this.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted some legislative reform to protect themselves from these from the banks. And so the banks were in the hands of some very, very clever, very intelligent people. They could see this coming. They could see the handwriting on the wall. And they said, basically, they said to each other, are we going to sit here and wait for some yokel in Congress or the Senate? Are we going to sit here and just wait for the American people to come up with some kind of legislation that's going to restrict our power? Or are we going to do something about it ourselves?
Mm-hmm.
And they decided that the best thing was to lead their own opposition. That if there was going to be a reform, if there was going to be legislation, they were going to be the ones
right,
to
right,
write it.
Right, right.
So that it could appear to be exactly what the American people wanted, but in fact, it would be just the opposite. And that's what they did. That's
mm-hmm.
that's the history. That's what I wrote about in my book, in The Creature from Jekyll Island, of how they got together, how they worked this out, how they pulled it off, how they sold it to the American people. It's just the opposite of what it was.
Why did you call the book, or why did you include, I guess, Jekyll Island in the title of the book? Let people know a little bit about Jekyll Island, the physical place.
Well, I had a little fun with that, Mike, because you know,
that's a great title, by the way. And
yeah.
You know, for, I mean, even when was Creature from Jekyll Island originally published?
Oh, I have to look at it myself.
20 years? I mean,
I'm whipping through here. The first printing was in 94.
94. So it's been 13 years.
Yeah.
Anyway, a remarkable book for people out there if you're not familiar with it, and many of my listeners are, I think. But if you're not, really a remarkable book. So anyway,
well, thank
please.
Thank you on that. Oh, but the reason for the title is that books have to have good titles.
Well, that's a killer one.
So I thought, well, the creature from Jekyll Island, it would conjure up this image of the creature from the Black Lagoon. Or maybe Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Right.
And so forth. So it had that little mysterious flavor to it.
And so it should.
Yeah, true. But in reality, Jekyll Island is just a plain little old island off the coast of Georgia. It's a real island, and it's historically significant for this topic because it was on that island in 1910 that the Federal Reserve System was created. It really is the creature from Jekyll Island. And thereby hangs a huge tale. You know, first of all, what was Jekyll Island in those days? In those days, Jekyll Island was a privately owned island. It was called the Jekyll Island Club. And it was a private place where it was owned by some of the leading billionaires of New York City, J.P. Morgan, William Rockefeller, and their business associates. This was a resort island where their families went to spend the winter months.
All right.
And they had a beautiful clubhouse there. It's still standing. You can visit it today. And it's in that clubhouse that they all went on a very secret journey back in 1910. A small group of seven of them traveled under conditions of great secrecy to Jekyll Island in order to draft the Federal Reserve Act. They didn't do that in Washington, D.C. Of course, this was something being done, as I mentioned a moment ago, to deceive people.
Who else was there?
Well, let me just read the list to you. Now, first of all, I'm going to read this list, but remember, the purpose of this meeting was to draft legislation which was supposed to break the grip of the money trust. All right. So here are the people who wrote that legislation. First one was Nelson Aldrich. He was the Republican whip in the Senate. He was the chairman of the National Monetary Commission, which was the special committee of Congress that was given the responsibility to propose this legislation. And he was a business associate of J.P. Morgan. He was a father-in-law to John D. Rockefeller, Jr. Just the kind of guy that is going to break the grip of the money trust.
Right.
Second was Abraham Piat Andrew. He was Assistant Secretary of the Treasury at that time. That doesn't tell you too much about it because he was really a banker. He came from a banking family.
But it shows you that their tentacles were already in the government.
Oh, yes, right. He was Assistant Secretary of the Treasury because he was a banker.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was Frank Vanderlip, who was President of the National City Bank of New York, which was the biggest and the most powerful of all the banks at that time, representing the financial interests of William Rockefeller and the international investment banking house of Kuhn, Loeb & Company. And then there was Henry P. Davison. He was the senior partner of the J.P. Morgan Company. Charles Norton was there. He was president of J.P. Morgan's First National Bank of New York. Benjamin Strong was there. He was head of J.P. Morgan's Bankers Trust Company. And finally, Paul Warburg was there.
Warburg, yeah.
Probably the most influential of the whole group. He was a full partner in Kuhn, Loeb & Company.
And Kuhn, Loeb, of course, is European, is English, right?
Warburg?
No.
He was German. He was a naturalized American citizen.
But Kuhn, Loeb is a German bank or an English bank?
Kuhn, Loeb is an American bank.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought it was an English bank for whatever reason.
Kuhn, Loeb was an American outfit on Wall Street.
Mm.
But Paul Warburg was a naturalized American citizen.
But a German.
He came from Germany.
Right.
And he was a partner in Kuhn, Loeb & Company.
Mm-hmm.
He was a representative of the Rothschild banking dynasty in England and France. And he maintained very close relationship to his brother, Max Warburg, who remained back in Europe and was head of the Warburg Banking Consortium in Germany and the Netherlands. Now, those are the people that wrote this legislation, which was supposed to break the grip of the money trust.
I mean, if it wasn't so ridiculously frightening after, you know, seeing the history of the whole thing, it is comical. I mean,
well, I guess you could say it's comical, but it's pretty classical, I would say. This sort of thing has been going on for a long time.
So par for the course.
Yes, and the American people do not suspect it.
And as usual, in other words, that people have been duped by the same old story for many years.
Yes, as long as you can slap something on a piece of legislation that makes it sound good, like the Federal Reserve Act was going to break the grip of the money trust. Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, the Patriot Act, right?
Patriot Act is going to preserve freedom. And so, oh, that's good, you know. And you don't look at who is promoting it and what their motives are and, you know, all the backroom deals. It's easy to lose the game, as I say.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know the game that's going on. So anyway, that's why they went to Jekyll Island, Mike, is so they could remain hidden from public view.
While they put this whole thing together.
While they put this whole thing together, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting story how they got there. The night of their departure in November, late November, they all gathered at the Hoboken Railroad Station in New Jersey. And there was a private railroad car that belonged to Nelson Aldridge. Having a private railroad car in those days, kind of like having your own private Learjet or maybe a private Boeing.
Right, right.
And so all these guys went to the railroad station in New Jersey, and they were told when they went there not to be seen together, not to dine together, not to talk to newspaper reporters. And when they all got on board this private car, they were told when they talked to each other not to use their last names. Use first names only. And two of them even dropped their first names and adopted code names. And when I first read that, I thought, that seems so strange. Why would they do that in the privacy of this railroad car? And then one of the participants later wrote an article about his journey, and he explained it. He said that the reason was that they were afraid that the servants on board the train might discover who everybody was, and that the servants would talk about it. And in that fashion, the word would get out. And so they used code names and that kind of thing. When they got to Jekyll Island, the staff that normally would serve the people there had been dismissed, and an entirely new temporary staff was brought in for this meeting for exactly the same reason, so that they would not know who these people were. So you look at all these, you know, all these measures of secrecy, and you realize that there were really very few wars of history that were plotted under conditions of greater secrecy than that.
Amazing.
So there were big stakes here. We're talking about control of the nation's money supply.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about a cartel being formed to literally capture control of the power to manufacture money for the United States of America.
Hey,
that's what came out of it.
Ed, is it a coincidence that shortly after the Federal Reserve Act is passed and this whole business gets implemented, that World War I ensues?
Well, I don't think it's...
I mean, I don't know if this is a left turn or not to take, or not, but it just sort of hit me, and I thought I'd ask you.
I don't think that the Federal Reserve formation had anything to do with the beginning or the cause of World War I.
All right.
But I do know that the financing of that war would have been very difficult, if not impossible, without the Federal Reserve Act, without the Federal Reserve in place, because that would have meant that the government would have had to go directly to the taxpayers and collect taxes for it or sell a huge amount of war bonds. But in this fashion, having the Federal Reserve in place, they could literally just create the money out of nothing and pass the cost on to the people, to the taxpayer, in the form of inflation.
Mm-hmm.
See, that's how the mechanism works. The government can run on either taxes or inflation. But you can't run on inflation unless you've got something like the Federal Reserve System, which can create money out of nothing.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit, about how money actually gets introduced into the system, and how Congress gets money, and then how that money is repaid.
Yes, that's a good topic, Mike. Let me go back and review what I just said about the Federal Reserve System being a cartel. There's one more thing we need to add to it, and that is that, it is a cartel, but it went into partnership with the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
The government had to participate in giving this cartel very special powers. The government literally gave this cartel the ability, the power to create our nation's money. That's something that the Constitution does not authorize.
Mm.
And anyway, they did it, and nobody challenged it. So we have a partnership here. We have a cartel.
What does the Constitution tell us?
Well, the Constitution, first of all, doesn't allow Congress to delegate its authority on anything. That's its authority. And secondly, even if you could say, well, if you had the authority, then there's an implied right to delegate it, then you have to say, well, all right, the Constitution limits even Congress from creating money out of nothing. Congress is severely limited by the Constitution to coin money based on silver and gold. That's
mm-hmm.
it.
Right.
It's not allowed to issue bills of credit or paper money, IOUs, or anything like that. That's very, very seriously prohibited by the Constitution. So Congress didn't have the right to do it themselves, and yet here they turn around and they delegate the right to the Federal Reserve System. So that's why I say it's totally unconstitutional at two levels.
Isn't a law that's passed that's unconstitutional sort of void regardless of whether it was passed or not? If you can ever get anyone to enforce it?
Yes, a law cannot be legitimate or cannot be honored, cannot be accepted as a proper law if it goes against the Constitution. At least that's the way it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, with the Supreme Court having all kinds of novel interpretations, there are ways around that. First of all, the Supreme Court can set aside the interpretation of the Constitution. They can say, well, that's not what they probably meant, you know. And, well, that's another issue.
Right. And many
Let me address that, though, because that sometimes is brought up. It's legitimate to say that sometimes issues in the Constitution are not self-evident when you just read the words as to what was meant by them. But all you have to do is go to the debates that led to the ratification of the Constitution
mm-hmm.
and see how they debated it back and forth. And there, very clearly, you can understand
mm-hmm.
what they meant
right.
by it.
Right.
And
right.
so when these Supreme Court justices say, well, we don't know what they meant by it, I mean, that's about as low as you can get because they're lying.
Mm-hmm.
They do know what was meant by it, but they use that chicanery
mm-hmm.
to justify twisting the intent of the Constitution to more of their views. So that makes me very angry when I think about what these Supreme Court justices do, and we have to pay them besides.
Mm.
But anyway, that's another topic.
Well, I think we can talk about this a little bit further into the program, but it sheds light on the cooperative nature of this whole thing. That pretty much everyone has bought into this whole thing, and the Justice Department, the federal judges, the Congress, everybody is playing along.
Well, yes, that's another topic. Can we come back to that one?
Yes,
I'd like to address that.
Yeah, we will. I want to be, because I think it's super relevant right now today. I mean,
yeah, but we were a moment ago headed toward the issue of how money is created, and I would like to come back to this gang mentality we have here, where, as you say, everybody seems to be going along with it because it's to their advantage.
Right.
But let's go back to how money is created.
Yeah, and the Federal Reserve. Yeah.
And the Federal Reserve. So the point I was trying to make is that we've got basically a partnership here between the federal government and the banking cartel. So when you have a partnership, there must be some advantage for both partners. Otherwise, they wouldn't be in it. So the question then is, what's the advantage to the government or to the politicians? And then we'll take a look at what's the advantage to the banks, the cartel. So we'll start with the political side, the political scientists, and see why they go along with this. And by the way, the answer to both of these questions can be found in how money is created.
Mm-hmm.
So here we go with that one. I'm going to describe this in kind of simplified terms. It's not actually exactly the way I'm going to describe it because I want to simplify it. But I can assure you that the essence of this mechanism is exactly as I am describing it.
Okay.
So here we go. Let's take a look at Congress. Now, Congress spends a lot of money. That congressmen like to spend money
right. Because
that's the way they get elected in today's world. They promise benefits, and people get something for nothing or advantages over their competitors or something they like, and they figure that the government can provide it for them. And so any politician that promises benefits is very popular, and he gets elected. Now, the problem with that is that these benefits cost money. So now, in order to pay for these benefits, the issue comes up, how are you going to get the money? And the obvious answer is to raise taxes. Well, the problem with that is that nobody wants to raise taxes, politicians, anyway, because that's unpopular. You can get elected by promising benefits, but you can get unelected by raising taxes.
Right.
So politicians have always had the problem of how do you provide more and more benefits without raising taxes?
Mm.
And, of course, the answer is, well, they can borrow it.
Okay. Back to the old borrowing game, yeah.
The borrowing game. You can borrow money that you don't have and you can pay it back later. So, meanwhile, the politicians say, well, we'll borrow this money. We'll issue bonds or treasury notes or bills or whatever, depending on their, the maturity dates. And so we'll go out and borrow $1 billion a day or whatever it is, and we won't have to raise taxes. And we can get reelected. That works for a while until finally these initial bonds come due. And they'll come due, 30 days later, 60 days later, 90 days later, a year later, and so forth. Now when the borrowed money has to be paid back, the politicians have another problem. They don't have it. And in fact, they not only don't have the money to pay back what they initially borrowed, by now they've promised even more benefits and they are even further in the hole.
Right.
So, not to worry. They say, we'll go back and we'll borrow some more. This time we'll borrow enough to cover the initial loan and the interest on the loan, and we'll go for another period of time in the sunshine. Well, and this goes on and on and on. The loans get bigger and bigger and bigger, and they never have enough to cover what they want to spend. So we have the phenomenon called the national debt. It just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
And the loans themselves are coming from the Federal Reserve.
Well, not necessarily. Let's talk about that. Actually, at the present time, a relatively small percentage of that comes from the Federal Reserve. Most of that money, Mike, comes from people like you and
from
me.
Taxes.
And corporations and banks, investment companies, insurance companies, other countries, people around the world that figure that they will loan money to the federal government of the United States because they figure it's a good investment. They'll get their money back plus interest, they think. And so most of the money comes from the private sector in one way or another.
But what happens, Ed, like, for example, when Congress says, okay, we need an extra $100 billion to fund the war in Iraq, for example.
Well,
where does that $100 billion come from? Because it always shows up. I mean,
yeah, they always get the money. Most of it comes from the private sector.
Oh, okay.
Or it may come from... They talk a lot about the Middle East, even.
Right.
It may come from Japan. Yeah. It may come from China.
Okay, so it can come from anywhere.
It can come from anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But now, there's only so much of it. Not all of it comes from the private sector. You see, as long as it comes from the private sector, there's no expansion of the money supply.
Mm-hmm.
The money is already there. They're just recycling it into loans.
Right.
And so the debt gets bigger and bigger and bigger. That can't go on forever, but right now it's still going on. But the money supply does not expand under this mechanism because the money is provided by people who've already got it.
Right.
But that's never enough. There's
right.
always a shortfall. And whatever it might be, it could be 10% of the total, could be 15%, could be 20% of the total, but there's always a shortfall. They can never borrow enough at the interest rates they're willing to pay. And that's where the chairman of the Fed is always struggling. Is he going to raise interest rates,
oh, yeah.
lower interest rates? He's always trying to figure out, you know, if he raises interest rates, then he can get more money from the private sector. If he lowers it, then they'll stop lending the money. And then the shortfall, now this is the critical part, comes from the Federal Reserve. Whatever does not come from the world, the Federal Reserve has promised to do. So
and,
now...
And that money, though, in other words, that 10%, that 15%, whatever it is, Congress goes to the Federal Reserve and says, okay, we raised 85%, but we still need another 15%. So Federal Reserve, we come to you to get it. Congress essentially borrows that money from the Federal Reserve?
That's exactly what happened.
And who pays it back?
Well...
and where does it come from before it gets
paid
back?
Well, that's the first question. Where did it come from? So if Congress goes to the Federal Reserve, okay, we need another $1 billion today, please.
Right.
Federal Reserve says, no problem, here's your check. The question is, where did that money come from? And the answer is, it came from thin air.
The ether.
Ether, yeah. It didn't exist prior to that law.
A keystroke creates it.
That's exactly it. That money is newly created money, and so it goes to the federal government, and the government says, great, we got the money. And they deposit it into their checking account. Now they can go
Lord.
Run their wars and pay their welfare and,
right.
and buy votes with it.
There you go.
Okay. So that's why the government is in the partnership. They can always get that additional amount of money at whatever rate of interest they're willing to pay.
All right, Ed, that's a good place to take a break, okay?
Yeah.
All right, top of the hour, everybody. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit. It's 1 a.m. now. On the 14th of August, 2007, back with G. Edward Griffin. Wonderful stuff, informative stuff, important, relevant stuff, and we'll get more into the current implications of all this information in a little while here when we come back, okay? All right, one more time, Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. G. Edward Griffin on the web at www.freedomforceinternational.org, freedomforceinternational.org, and also on the web at www.realityzone.com. Okay, you can link to all those sites from mine at mikehagan.com, and this program, as well as the previous program that was done with Ed back in September of 2004, believe it or not, will be up and available in the archives, as all of the programs are, within the next 24 hours or so, okay? All right, here's a piece of music. We'll come back with that in just a few minutes. It's Mike, and this is Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia.
Don't want to say easy, man. I'm serious. Imagine me like your girlfriend's parents or something, and they ask you, what do you do for a living? Now, how the hell do I sound talking about I'm a rapper? You know what I mean? I mean, look at the frame you place yourself in right there. This is hard, man. Yo, I be writing the illest of riddles and opening act over noses of middlemen, climbing the ladders and fingering ligaments, running on rappers and hurting their feelings. And I get my fingers to thinking and scribbling, touching the tempo, bending them synonyms, giving you optic illusions and sentences. Grinning, my diction has never been impotent. On my fist, I'm addicted to thrills. Records that spin it make pay for they self. Swell in our pockets, a better all health. How can it hit if it sit on the shelf? Say Caribbean, we've been there, we've done that. From Sicily, Sweden, we've been there, we've done that. Rock Europeans, Japan, and the London. This is us getting it just how we wanted it. This ain't the best I could do, I just toy with it. Rhyming the minutes, I'm finished recording it. All I could do is get down and performing it. This is us getting it just how we wanted it. Just how we wanted it.
Snatching the mazes, after a breath to the crack to the face. Beginning of a trainer to demonstrate the cases. Here for a dope, so I open my aces. No hands, no hands, they shall be praised. No man, no stand, they blow away. I take it to the limit, I'm in it, there'll be no gimmicks. I'm not in the danger, but I don't need to see the winner. But I skip down a yellow brick road. Keeping a gold bridge, can I better get more? Got a little time, but they better get low. Love my life, I ain't never hit no. My
every breath still definite, no. Make MCs up and ever get old. I know it no when I let it kiss cold. Pavement ablaze and it never gets old. I should dumb up a little bit, sit with them record executives, getting with sex is the message, is best you consider it. If it ain't negative, ain't no one listening. Kill a few cats in your song every now and then. Sing for the dog in the song. If I said gangster and hoe in the sentence and throwing some fiction, some motherfucking uplift, then y'all will be bumping the song. Am I wrong? Y'all will be singing along. Get it on. This is the act of mathematics and emphasis done by a fraction of those who are clashing. The magic established turned golden in form. You don't know what I just said. Get it on. I skip the flesh and just tattoo the heaven. They kick for my records like mummies and Kemet. It's death and I dream. It's the making of legends. Nothing has changed, but now everything's different.
More music I'm unfamiliar with, but thanks to the people who sent that to me, and I appreciate it. All right, it's my KOPN Columbia 89.5 FM Radio Orbit. G. Edward Griffin with us on the line from his place in California. We're privileged to have him with us for a couple hours tonight, and say hello. Ed, thanks for sticking around.
Well, it's my pleasure, Mike.
All right, so
my favorite topic.
Yeah, it's amazing, actually, every time I dwell upon it, I get more and more, a whole bunch of things. I get frustrated, I get mad, but I also get really interested because I look around at what's happening in the world today and I think, well, it's all related to this stuff and it's just interesting to me because I don't know exactly what's going on, but I'm not sure anybody really does at this point. but maybe I'm wrong about that. I guess we'll talk about that in a little while. But to sort of pick up where we left off before the break, essentially, we made the point that the Federal Reserve loans money to the U.S. government, but it loans that money out of nowhere. It creates the money out of thin air, essentially, and then the U.S. Congress borrows money that's been created out of thin air, but then pays it back. And the people that pay it back basically are us, right?
That's right. That's us. Of course, that's us. The taxpayers pay it back, and they pay it back plus interest. But now, let me point out something here. Many people run to the wrong conclusion that this is a big ripoff on the part of the Federal Reserve, that here they're collecting interest on this money, and they just created the money out of nothing. But this is the small end of the teeter-totter, Mike. This is small potatoes compared to the point we're going to go to next. Because what actually happens is that the interest that the people pay to the Federal Reserve System for this money created out of nothing is used to pay for the Federal Reserve System itself, and what is not used is sent back to the Treasury. It's an apparent act of great generosity. So
explain a little bit more about how that works, Ed.
Well, let's just say that the interest on the the amount of money that the government borrows from the Federal Reserve. Remember, this is the small end of the deal. It's not the big end. That interest, let's just say, is $20 billion.
Okay.
Just pull a number out of thin air.
Right. Yeah, that's appropriate.
Those numbers are small today. And let's assume that the cost of running the Federal Reserve System and all of its branches around the country is $4 billion. So after the $4 billion is consumed to run the Federal Reserve, the balance, the $16 billion, is returned to the Treasury, returned to the taxpayer.
Hmm.
And so it looks like the Federal Reserve is very generous. The fact is, though, the taxpayer just completely pays for the operation of the Federal Reserve, and so if they have a business, their little cartel is run completely paid for by the taxpayers. But that's not where the problem really is, as I said before. Remember, there's a partnership here. We can see why the government is in the partnership is because they can get any amount of money that they really need at the interest that they're allowed that want to pay.
Mm-hmm.
From the Federal Reserve. That's the agreement. But why are the banks in it? Let's answer that question by following some of this money that was created for the government. Let's just take $1,000 that is given to the government by the Federal Reserve, newly created money out of thin air, and the government takes that and spends it on the salary of, let's say, the postal worker. Okay. Now, here's a guy that's delivering the mail, and he gets a check for $1,000 from his employer, the government. He doesn't know that that money is newly created. He doesn't really care. It's spendable money. It's in a paycheck, the government paycheck. So he takes it down the street to his bank and deposits it into his private banking account.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is where the action heats up. Now that money is out of the Federal Reserve side, the government side, and it comes into the banks as a deposit.
Mm-hmm.
Now watch what happens. Let's assume that I am the banker of this bank that this fellow deposited the money into. And I'm sitting over there at my desk, and when I see the deposit, I might stand up and say, "Attention, everybody, I want to announce that this gentleman has just made a deposit, and we have money now to lend." And everybody's happy because a lot of those people are in there to borrow money, not to deposit money,
right,
but to borrow money.
Right.
And they know that the more that the bank has to lend, the cheaper the interest rates. And so they're overjoyed. Now, let's assume that you're there and you say, "Well, that's great news. I want to borrow $9,000 for this car I saw, this used car. How much did he deposit?" And I would say, "Well, he deposited $1,000. And then you might say, "Well, that's not enough for me. I need $9,000. And then I would say to you, "Sir, don't worry about it. We can loan $9,000 to you." And then you might say, "Well, how can you do that?" And I would say, "Don't worry about it. It's all taken care of. It's very complicated. You don't need to know.
Right.
It's all guaranteed by the Federal Reserve. It's quite legal, you know. This is how America is run. We can loan you $9,000. Based on that $1,000 deposit." And this is true.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Federal Reserve requires that all banks keep only 10% of their outstanding loans in reserve. They call it reserve.
Right, in the vault, in the bank, whatever.
Somewhere.
Somewhere, yeah. Who knows where?
No, it's in the computer.
Yeah, there you go.
Put it on a piece of paper under a ledger under the heading that says reserve. And
the whole thing is so ridiculous when you
say these are just numbers, Mike. There's no money. Remember, there's no gold or silver.
Right.
These are numbers.
Right. I know.
It's a numbers game.
It's just ridiculous.
As the banker, I can put that $1,000 under the column that says reserve. Now, the Federal Reserve requires me to keep 10% of my outstanding loans in reserve. I've got $1,000 in reserve. So that's 10% of what? That's 10% of 10,000.
10 grand, right.
So that gives me 9,000 that I can now loan. And so I can loan you that $9,000. And the question is, where did the money come from? And it came from the same place it came when the Federal Reserve loaned it to the government, out of thin air. So that means that for every $1 billion that is created out of nothing for the federal government to use, an additional, up to an additional $9 billion can be created out of thin air at the commercial bank level to loan to people like you and me to buy things with. And they don't have the money at all. They just create it out of thin air. Now, that's pretty amazing. If you and I were to do that, you know, we'd go to jail. But they can do it because they're part of the banking system, and that was all set up by the Federal Reserve Act, which was written by the bankers on Jekyll Island back in 1910.
Right. So if you're a member of the gang, you can do it. If you're not, you can't.
That's right. And if you're a member of the partnership and you scratch the politician's back, then they'll scratch your back and allow you to do things that the common man could not do.
Now
notice on this that when the money is created out of nothing for the government spends it for its purposes, its wars. It uses it for its welfare, its government projects, all of the things that make it popular with the voters, its salaries and so forth. But when they create money out of nothing and give it to the borrower, that's not used by the bank.
Mm.
So the bank doesn't use it for its purposes. It loans it, but it collects interest on it. And this is the key. You see, the bank is able to collect interest on nothing. And if you just think about that for a minute, you know, that is the most amazing sleight of hand that you could possibly imagine. Collecting interest on nothing. When the banks say, well, we only charge, you know, a low interest rate, 7-8%, and we have to pay half of that to the depositors, they're not telling you the whole truth.
They're
paying that to their depositors who put in that, say, $1,000, but they're not saying anything about the additional $9,000 that was created out of nothing. There are no depositors to pay off for that. That's all free and clear.
You know, Ed, there's a listener who's making a comment in the chat room, and you just use the term sleight of hand, and this person writes, money equals sorcery.
Maybe
you could talk a little bit about how this is all like sort of a magic trick. I mean, it's magicians at work.
It's an illusion, yes. It is. Money is, in today's world, an illusion. And I think the word scam is not necessarily a bad word. I think scam, you could probably classify this as a scam. If it weren't legal, if it hadn't been legalized,
and so
well recognized, it's well accepted by everybody for so long. We just accept this in our daily lives. If it weren't for that, I think you'd have to say this was a scam.
There was, what was the guy's name, Ponzi?
Yes, Ponzi.
Is that a reasonable reference?
Well, I think Ponzi is a little bit different. Ponzi didn't create money out of nothing. This is a greater scam than Ponzi.
He was just an amateur, yeah.
Yeah, all Ponzi did was steal money from people with false promises.
Right. He couldn't steal what they didn't have, right?
Yeah, he just stole what they had. And at the end, they all knew that they'd been taken.
Right,
with this scheme, the system steals it from you a little bit at a time through inflation. And at the end, you don't even know you've been swamped.
Oh, man.
All you know is that it costs a lot more to live today than it did 10 years ago, and you don't know who to blame.
All right. I'm going to find out who to blame. The Federal Reserve banking system, the Federal Reserve network of banks, you said early in the program that it is a private corporation. So I know that private corporations have shareholders. So, do we know who the shareholders of the Federal Reserve are?
This is a yes and a no answer. I hate those, but this is one case where it's valid. First of all, it is a corporation. I don't think I said it was a private corporation.
Right, no, you said it was a special corporation,
Yeah, it was a hybrid. It was a special corporation created by the Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And it has, I think the word is hybrid. it looks like it's half government and half private corporation, but it's neither. It's a true hybrid, just for this purpose. It is a corporation, but it's unlike other corporations in some important ways. First of all, there are stocks that are held, but the stocks do not carry all of the privileges of ownership that stocks would carry in a normal corporation. For example, you cannot, if you hold a stock in the Federal Reserve, you cannot sell it. Okay, you have to hold it because you're a bank.
That means you can't buy it either, though, right?
What?
I mean, you probably can't buy it either, then.
No, you can't buy. You have to buy it, a certain quantity of it, if you come into the Federal Reserve System. It's sort of mandatory.
Right.
It's more for appearances than anything else. But you can't sell it. It doesn't carry voting rights. You can't. The people who hold the stock cannot vote their chairman of the Federal Reserve. That's appointed by the president. And so forth. So the important elements.
So the chairman of the Federal Reserve is appointed by the president.
Appointed by the presidency. That's where it's the hybrid.
I would argue that the president is probably appointed by the Federal Reserve.
Yes, bingo, Mike. Bingo. let's be realistic. The people that run the Federal Reserve have such tremendous influence over the political process that I can guarantee you nobody gets to be president or even nominated by the major parties unless they have the nod of the people at the Federal Reserve.
Mm. I know of, I don't know, but there's plenty been written about John Kennedy and about his trouble with the Federal Reserve.
Well, I almost hate to get into that because...
Yeah, me too, but I mean, I just...
The reason I hate it is because I'm a contrarian on that one.
Oh, really?
I don't think that's true. I think that's nervous.
Well, he had plenty of enemies.
He had plenty of enemies, yeah. But the Federal Reserve was not one of them.
Okay, all right. Well, yeah, in fact, his dad probably was a whole part of that whole gang, probably.
Yeah, well, anyway, I just wanted to let you know that I don't subscribe to the theory that JFK was assassinated because he was going to return the country to sound money.
Okay, all right.
I wish he was going to do that.
Oh, clear. Well,
the record doesn't.
Good. I'm glad. I'm glad that you.
I covered that in the book and even at more length on our website for anybody that's interested as to why I don't believe that. I know it's commonly stated and it's massively circulated on the internet. But so if anybody's thinking why wouldn't I go along with that, you'll find it at our website, and I think there are good reasons for that.
Okay. All right.
But anyway, back to the creation of money. So there you have it. The banks are able to create an unlimited amount of money out of nothing and charge interest on it. And as a result, the money supply in the nation keeps expanding and expanding and expanding, and it expands at a rate faster than the rate of goods and services are expanding, which means that the purchasing value of the dollar goes down, down, and down. And your lost purchasing power, Mike, goes somewhere. Many people think, well, gee, I've lost my purchasing power. I guess it just went to heaven. I don't know. Where did
it go? Right, where did it go? Yeah, why did... I mean, and I experienced that on a... And I'm sure, you know, many of the listeners and you too and whoever else. I mean, I'm experiencing that on a regular basis in a real life, you know, experiential thing where I go to the grocery store and eggs are more expensive than they were a month ago, you know, and...
Yeah, and we're going to see that even more so in the near future. But where does it go? The answer is very simple. It goes to the two partners in this cabal.
Uh-huh. The governor and the Fed.
It goes to the government and to the banking cartel. Mm. They acquire every bit of our lost purchasing power. So, you know, here we have a situation where in ancient Rome, if you had wanted to buy let's say you had a 1 ounce gold coin,
Right.
I've forgotten what they call them. There was a common name, and it just skipped my mind. Anyway, a 1 ounce gold coin, common gold coin at the time, Realidad or something like that. Anyway, you could buy a nice toga, a handcrafted belt, and a pair of sandals for a 1 ounce gold coin. That was the price. Today, thousands of years later, if you have a 1 ounce gold coin without any particular numismatic value, just a Cougaron or an American gold eagle, and you take that to the bank and convert it into Federal Reserve notes, you can walk into a man's store and buy a nice suit, a handcrafted belt, and a pair of shoes. In other words, money, when it has intrinsic value, does not lose its purchasing power for thousands of years.
And for listeners out there who aren't familiar with the precious metals markets, what gold, $670 an ounce or so, plus or minus, right?
Yeah, that's the range. Uh-huh.
And that makes, I mean, if you haven't been to the tailor lately, but about $700 will get you a pretty decent suit, a pair of shoes, and a nice belt.
That's my point.
Yeah, I mean, it's really true.
It's true. And meanwhile, these things we call Federal Reserve notes, it takes more and more and more of them to buy anything because they keep creating more and more and more of them. And the people who create them are the ones that are benefiting from this. They're mm-hmm. the ones that are capturing that lost purchasing power.
Right.
So if you don't like it, what are you going to do about it?
Hmm.
See, it's time for reform, but you're not going to have reform anytime soon because right now, I'm sorry to say, the average American doesn't know anything at all about this.
And the last time we had reform, it was by the people that did the reforming that were in the...
You know. Yeah. Yeah. So this is not only going to take some political agitation, but some understanding as well, enlightenment.
Okay, let me ask you a question here. We've got about... Well, actually, we have as much time as we want before we take a break. But earlier we were talking about this idea that not only was the Federal Reserve doing its bidding, but lots and lots of other organizations, institutions, banks, agency of the U.S. government, et cetera, they have to play along for the most part. Or maybe they don't have to, but they are. And I'm thinking about when we talked 3 years ago, and you talked about this guy named Norman Dodd, who's amazing, and I was so blown away that I went and saw some of his writings and videos and stuff, primarily investigating these tax-exempt foundations. But at any rate, maybe you could talk a little bit more about how sinister and how prolific the whole business is.
Mike, I see you're having trouble finding the right words, and I don't blame you, because it is difficult to find the right words to describe the enormity of the problem today. It's not just the money. I agree that the money is certainly very important and may even be the nerve center of the whole mechanism. But it's not just the money. It's an attitude. It's a control over the thinking of the American people. It's a control. Well, what is control over a society? If you wanted to control society, there are two ways of doing it. The ancient way was to get an army with lots of soldiers and swords, and you went forth and conquered.
Right, just do it overtly.
Yeah, just do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that method still is tried.
Right.
True. I mean, no modern conquerors are ever going to give up the sword as a last resort. But along the way, they have learned that there are more efficient ways and less dangerous ways to the rulers to do it. And the answer is that they control people's minds.
Mm.
If they can control people's attitudes, their information flow, and what they think about what's going on in the world, boy, that's a huge step forward. And then if they can control people's money, that's another way to go at minds and money and military. Those are your three M's there.
You know, Ed, there's a gentleman that I've had on the program a couple times who I like, and we talk about lots of different topics, but his name is Richard Allen Miller, and he's an herb farmer these days, but he was NSA in the early 70s and in the 60s, worked for the National Security Agency, right? And he said on the air with me that back in the late 60s, when the CIA and the other intelligence agencies were getting a load of television and they actually started to grok what it really meant. He said that they all looked at each other. And it was there was no secrets, no nothing. Everybody looked at each other and said, "This is all we need. The television. It was it."
You mean to control the masses?
Right.
Yeah.
They had that. That was the tool, right? And they all knew it.
Well, it is the tool. The communications media is the tool. It's not just television. We have to give honorable mention to the motion picture industry to radio and the press. But, television is the main channel by which people have visions or concepts of what's going on in the world, how they interpret reality. I mean, you can take the worst villain in the world and describe him as Chairman, and Chairman Mao, or Chairman of some...
President Musharraf.
Could give him a title,
right.
And it sounds okay. You take the greatest guy in the world and call him Dictator Smith, or Strongman Smith, or Warlord Smith, you know, just by putting words in front of their names.
Mm-hmm.
That alone, you know, makes a huge difference.
Right, it's a manipulation of language, you know.
Yes, it's language, and now images. We
should
know that there's images coming back from Iraq are being carefully filtered, and in some cases manufactured. But the average person doesn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, how do you break that? And I don't really know the answer to that, except that we have to keep trying.
Mm-hmm.
We just have to be careful of our facts, and it's very easy to overstate things in order to make a point. I try very hard not to do that, so that no one can come back at me and say, "Well, you exaggerated on this. That wasn't true what you said." If they can find one little mistake or exaggeration,
then the whole thing somehow becomes invalid.
Yeah, that takes care of him, you know.
right.
So that's unfortunate, because you can be on the other side of the argument and make all kinds of exaggerations and nobody challenges it.
Well, I think people are getting more hip to that whole thing too, you know.
Well, I hope you're right.
Let me ask you this. A number of people have asked over the course of the program, and I'm just getting to it now, but people are asking about the Amero and this idea of the North American Union, and they'd like your opinion and about that whole idea.
Well, I can tell you a lot about that, but it's not opinion. It's a fact.
Well, what's happening?
The fact is that for as long as I can remember reading about this thrust toward world government, the planners, leaders, the shakers, have always said that world government cannot be built all at once. It has to be assembled in stages. They said the people will never give up their sovereignty for a global government where they must be merged with all the cultures and legal systems and political systems of the world all at once. You have to ease them into it in stages through regional groupings. And they've always, goes back to the 60s when I was reading about this. They said the plan is to break the world up into three or four large regional groups: Europe, North America, Asia, Africa, and the nations there will be more willing to merge their sovereignty with nations in their regions, and then after a period of time they've become used to that, maybe a generation goes by, then they'll merge all of those regions into a true global government based on the model of collectivism, which is, of course, total control.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is merely the fulfillment of a plan, a strategy that was well stated decades ago. We see it unfolding. We saw it unfolding in Europe, and the creation of the
European Union,
right. And then the Euro. Mm-hmm. And everybody in America says, "Gee, aren't they stupid to do that?" And all of a sudden, underneath their very noses, they find out that the political leaders of Mexico, the United States, and Canada are doing the same thing without any reference to Congress or to the people of those countries. They're just doing it.
Yeah, and not only that, they've seen their own currency, the dollar, be overshadowed by the euro, the one that they used to make fun of. Now the euro is worth, a buck and a half or something.
Yeah, well, that's not because of the strength of the euro. It's because of the weakness of the dollar.
Right, right. And that's been done by design, too, I imagine.
I'm sure, at least to
a certain extent.
To a large extent. You see, I think in order to get the American people to accept an Amaro or an Amero, however they want to pronounce it,
mm-hmm.
what would do that?
Well, yeah.
The answer is complete devastation of the dollar.
The dollar, exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
They said, this dollar is no good anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the dollar finally collapses into the toilet, then people will say, oh, maybe the Amaro will be the better thing, you see.
Mm-hmm. Right, right, the next best thing, right?
Well, save us with the Amaro.
Mm-hmm. And so this is the idea, is to combine Canada, the U.S., and Mexico and Central America, essentially?
Not essentially, period. That's it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, the three nations will no longer be three nations. They'll be part of a regional political unit.
Right.
And that's well on its way.
Mm-hmm.
That is definitely on the agenda at the leadership levels of all three countries. The people of those countries, for the most part, don't have any idea that it's planned. And if they did have an idea, they don't want it. But that doesn't make any difference because the people of these countries have no control over their political leaders.
This is a good opportunity to talk about the current situation in U.S. and, I guess, global economics, the liquidity crisis, quote-unquote, that's going on. I mean, is it your opinion that this is all, again, theater, manufactured?
No, I wouldn't go so far as to say that. I think that the largest part of what we're seeing in this liquidity crisis is not necessarily theater. I think it's just the consequences of theater.
Mm.
It's the
what consequences. A great way to put it. That's very well put, I think.
Yeah, the theater has been going on, and now the consequences are upon us, and they're going to do everything they can to ameliorate them and keep the bubble going. But when it bursts, their plan is clearly to use the chaos as an excuse
mm-hmm.
to impel everybody to the next stage in the plan, which would be the merger of currencies into regional currencies and eventually into a universal global currency.
Right.
And many people might say, what's wrong with that? The answer is there's nothing wrong with that if the currency was to be sound, if it were to be based on something of intrinsic value. But in truth of the matter is that the currency that will evolve from this will be another fiat currency,
right.
No difference in principle from the American dollar or the British pound or any of the other major currencies, which means that they will just continue to lose value, and the people of the world will continue to lose value through this hidden taxation called inflation.
Mm-hmm.
So there's plenty wrong with it.
Right. Okay, I'm looking at the clock here, and I got a lot of questions, so I want to get the good ones, okay?
Sure.
This is one that I'm very interested in, and I'm not sure. Well, I'll just ask it this way. Computers. This may seem strange, but people are talking about the markets, the New York Stock Exchange, the Dow Jones, the NASDAQ, the FTSE, all this stuff, right? And the question is, how dependent are they upon technology and computers? In other words, all this stuff seems to be just, out of thin air. I mean, Maybe a better way to put it is, how tenuous is their grip on the whole thing? You've written and talked quite a bit about terrorism and this sort of stuff. I mean, how easy or how vulnerable is the system to technological failure or collapse or attack or whatever?
Well, Mike, there are a lot better qualified people than myself to address that issue. But there's no lack of editorial opinion around on this topic. I mean, everybody's got some pretty strong opinions on it. Even beyond the realm of opinion, there's no question that the electronic infrastructure is delicate. It's certainly vulnerable to any kind of aggressive, malicious attack on the part of a country, a rogue country that wanted to just destroy our infrastructure. We know, this is not speculation, but we know that China, for example, for quite a long time has been working on ways to do exactly that, and they've been even practicing, and they, you know, they've got an elite corps that are ready to go whenever they say go, and they recently have been demonstrating the prowess of some of their missiles to take out satellites and so forth. The Chinese military have said that in their strategy papers that the American devil, as they call him, is a very strong, powerful beast and cannot be defeated on the battlefield, but his brain is very weak and delicate. His brain meaning the electronic systems which run our society, the banking interconnections, the communications connections, and so forth. They said the brain is very delicate and very vulnerable, and we can kill him through his brain. We know this is not speculation. That's all been exposed and brought out, even some of it leaked out by our own government. Mm. And they generally try and conceal that kind of thing because they don't want to alarm the American people.
Right.
So it, on the face of it, it's obvious that our society is very vulnerable to technological attack.
Mm.
But beyond that, I don't know what effect it would have and for how long it would have an effect.
Right, before the next thing just sort of fills the vacuum or whatever.
Yeah, what would fill the vacuum?
Right.
I don't know.
Interesting, yeah.
I just don't know. I do know that if we had real money in place, that would fill the vacuum.
Right.
And in fact, that might trigger real money into existence.
Well, here's another question that I think is directly related to that, and it also ties into what we were talking about earlier about this idea of the intrinsic value of money, and in other words, the actual money itself, the coin or whatever it is, actually has some sort of purpose or can be used for something other than, you know, to purchase other goods. And a listener asks about the medicinal quality of silver and says, is this one of the reasons why silver was included among the precious metals historically? Because it has medicinal qualities. And I know that you've investigated cancer and some other health-related issues. Do you have a comment on that? I think it's really interesting.
That's an interesting comment. I am aware of the prophylactic value of silver, that trace amounts of high quality pure silver is very effective in killing all kinds of germs and bugs and viruses and things. So it's a very effective way to do it, but it doesn't take much, just trace amounts.
Mm.
I'm not aware of that being a factor in silver becoming
valuable or something.
Value,
right,
as a monetary unit,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Although it may, it's hard to imagine because there's so little silver required.
Right, right. But again, it's just the idea that it's useful for that if required,
yes.
You know?
Yes, yes.
Mm. Okay, all right. Well, we got about 10 minutes, Ed, so I'd like to ask you your opinion about the current situation on planet Earth. What do you think is happening? And where do you think it's going? And maybe, I guess, we could talk a little bit toward the end of the program about what you think people might be doing to help themselves in the middle of this whole thing.
That's quite a door to go through. The world and everything in it, and what do we do about it? Well, okay, let's see how far.
Yeah, I mean, what do you think is happening? You know, just what do you think is happening in your own, you know, your own opinion? I'm just curious about your opinion.
Yeah. Well, I think that there's some good news and some bad news, as they say. It's easy to see the bad news. So let's do that first and then get that out of the way.
That's what's sort of shared with everyone. They like everyone to see the bad news, but very little of the good news, I think, is shared.
Right. So the bad news is that our freedoms are rapidly running out. They're being whittled away every day. And some of those chunks they're taken out of late are big chunks. It's practically nothing left of our Constitution. All we need is for King George to declare some kind of a national emergency, and he already has the executive power to do anything he wants to do. We would have no constitutional protections whatsoever under conditions of a national emergency declared by the President of the United States.
And this is via executive order and all this other crap.
Executive orders. And you know, the Congress has just rubber-stamped everything. The Congress that we have in there now, it was not going to object in any way. They've had plenty of time to do that. They've shown that they have no backbone. They want to be part of the system.
Yeah.
They are part of the system. They're part of the problem. So that's the bad news.
Yeah, if you don't see that now, by the way, you know.
It's nothing to do with Republicans versus Democrats.
Right, that is complete foolishness.
Both branches of the same problem.
Right.
But they like to go back and forth to let you think you're solving the problem by throwing the rascals out, throw those Republicans out, and get in the good Democrats. And then, oh, that didn't work. Throw those bad Democrats out and get in the good Republicans. Oh, that didn't work. So back and forth. They've been playing that game for, a century, actually.
And it's short memory that's just killing us, you know?
Yeah. Well, see, people can't imagine that the game is even being played. They just can't imagine that anybody would do that. They don't question that there's all kinds of deceit and practiced deceit on the football field. I mean, to win a game, they understand that deceit is what you have to do. But in global politics, surely these good politicians wouldn't use deceit, would they? You know, that's the kind of naivety that we face.
What do they call it? Cognitive dissonance, right?
The cognitive dissonance, I like that.
Right.
Yes. And anyway, so that's the bad news. Now, the good news. The good news is that many, many people are waking up. Now, that's been going on for a long time, but I have to tell you that the numbers right now are gargantuan numbers.
How do you judge that in your own world?
Well, I judge that by just the people I talk to, and I judge that by the number of people that are coming on board for the Ron Paul campaign, for example.
Hear, hear.
Yes. If you look at the numbers out there, it's just fantastic. And mostly young people,
mm-hmm.
I'll say this.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, does that encourage me. I'm an old duffer.
Man.
But most of the people of my age are just too, they make me sick. You know, they're just too content. They have no idealism. They have no fire, no life. But boy, I see these young kids out there rallying behind mm-hmm. Ron Paul.
Right.
And I think, my God, this is something that I haven't seen since I became part of this movement in 1960.
Well, I'll tell you what, Ed, I've been following Ron Paul in the Congress for a number of years only because he's one of the few people that's been standing out. I mean, and this goes back as long as he's been there, 10 years or so, you know.
Yeah.
I couldn't be more thrilled that he's doing what he's doing and that he's getting the response that he's getting. I'd love to get him on the program here. I've actually tried to contact his people a couple of times, and hopefully before the election goes down, I'll be able to do that. But regardless, I think that he is certainly a bright spot.
Yeah, there's no question about it. Now, we have to be realistic. We know that they're going to go after Ron in a very vicious manner.
Oh, and they have already, yes.
They've just begun. But nevertheless, that's encouraging. That's part of the
mm-hmm.
good news. I see a groundswell. And now, for the really good news is that our organization, Freedom Force International, is growing by leaps and bounds. I know we don't have time to talk about it, but I do want to just say for your listeners that we have an organization that is quite different from anything that has ever been done before. Even in history, I have to go so far as to say that. I didn't think that was something so profound was going to come out of our little effort when we started with Freedom Force 3 or 4 years ago. But now that it's matured, I realize that nothing like this has ever been done before in history. And what's that? It's a group of people around the world. We now have members in over 50 countries. Mm. It just blows me away. A group of people around the world who are determined to take back control of the power centers of society, not just complain about the problem, not just to read books and hold seminars,
right,
wring our hands and right, all that, but to actually reach out and try to take back control over our own systems. And it can be done because we've seen our opponents do it.
Right,
it's just that they were busy at it while we were playing our game. And now it's time to quit playing games, folks, and get back into the arena and take back control. So that's actually happening. And then in addition to that, this group, is what makes it truly unique is that the group has a set of principles. We know what we believe in as well as what we're opposed to.
Well, Ed, you know, if I can jump in, I'll tell people that if you go to the front page of my website, you'll see that the text that's below tonight's program headline is part of what's called the Creed of Freedom.
That's it.
And what Ed and his organization are doing is essentially helping people to not only do what he's talking about, talk about stuff, but actually get back involved and grab the reins of government in local, regional, whatever areas. And the Creed of Freedom, which is remarkable and says a lot of things that I think many of my listeners would agree with, sort of sets the tone for how that can be accomplished.
Well, you see, you have to look ahead. You have to believe, as I do, that someday we will recapture control.
Oh, yeah,
I'm
certain.
And when that happens, then what? Are we going to become just like the guys we're fighting?
Right.
Are we going to be corrupted by power?
Right.
No, we can't let that happen. And so we have to have our creed. We have to know what we believe in and set that as a gyroscope for our whole movement. So we have that in place, and it's growing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very encouraging. So that's the good news.
All right. Well, it is, and I've been, although you and I haven't been in direct contact for quite a while, I've been paying attention, and I snoop around your site often enough to know.
That's good. We like to have that.
Yeah, and I know a lot of other people do too, and like you say, there's a whole lot happening right now. Very little of it will be covered by CNN, I think, at least the stuff that you and I think is so relevant. And it doesn't mean that it's not happening, and it doesn't mean that we can't do exactly what we intend to do.
And we will. The only trouble is that if we expect it to happen real quick, it's not going to happen real quick.
Isn't that the truth? That's sort of my historical faux pas. I always think things are going to happen quicker than they actually do, and I'm always frustrated by the fact that they don't happen soon enough, you know?
Well, I am too. But nevertheless, we know that they will happen, and that in itself, that is a very, very uplifting thought. It may not even happen in our lifetime, probably not in mine, but it could in yours. And who cares? Mm-hmm. We have set in motion, Mike, we have set something in motion now that is unstoppable.
Mm-hmm.
Sooner or later, it will be victorious.
I agree with you there, Ed. I agree with you there. All right, I tell you what, that's a good place to say goodbye, I think.
Okay, we've done our job. We've done our mischief, and maybe we've upset a few people and encouraged a few people at the same time.
Let's hope both.
All right. Thanks, Mike, for having me on.
Ed, it's been a pleasure. Take care of yourself. I'll talk to you again.
All right. Good night.
All right, everybody. Ed Griffin, G. Edward Griffin, everybody. It's been a pleasure and a privilege to have Ed on the program. Check it out on the web, www.freedomforceinternational.org. Much of Ed's material is also available on the web at www.realityzone.com. You can link to both of those websites as well as this program and the previous program that we did with Ed back in September of 2004 on the website at mikehagan.com, and go to the program archives. You can download and share that stuff with your friends. Well, we've got about 6 or 7 minutes before we have to bow out of here and let Ruthie in the door for a little crash landing, as we do every week. Good music coming up for you for the next few hours. Ruth will be in here in just a few minutes. Next week on the program, we have a big birthday celebration. Radio Orbit on the air 3 years next week. Lots of live music in the studio with me. Lots of good friends. lots of guests and friends of the program on the phone with us, I'm sure. We'll have some surprises and a good time for all right? So we'll lighten things up next week, have a great time, a little bit of partying here at KOPN 915 East Broadway. Join us. If you're listening to the program and you want to be a part of the party next week, just come on down. You're welcome. Everybody who hears the show and is within earshot is welcome in the door. Okay. What else? The week after that, John Major Jenkins. Yeah, so JMJ back in a couple weeks. One more time, a big thank you to G. Edward Griffin, the author of Creature from Jekyll Island, among other amazing books and publications. But he's an amazing guy and done a whole lot of great stuff over a number of years. And I hope that you'll all take the time to investigate him and his work, okay? All right, it's Mike. You've been listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. One more time, stick around. We got Ruth coming up with Crash Landing. We'll hear one more piece of music that I'm not familiar with to close out the program. And I love you all. Talk to you next week.